Welcome to the special New Year's edition of Political Rewind. We're all getting set to go out in some form or another and celebrate the arrival of 2018. And on today's show, we've decided to take a look back at the big events, what our panel today thinks are the big events of 2017. We've counted them down from 10 to 1. Greg Bluestein, political reporter at the AJC, gave us his list. Dr. Andra Gillespie, a political science professor at Emory University, and of course, Jim Galloway, who, Jim, my New Year's resolution is that this year I will correctly say that not only do you have a column on Wednesdays and Sundays, but you oversee the Political Insider blog on Politically Georgia at my AJC.
Ding, ding, ding.
There we go. We got that. And I've got to tell you, I'm taking a look at this list, and I'm really out of sync with the rest of y'all.
I felt the same way.
I did too. And we'll talk about that. We did, Tom Faust, our producer, he took this very, very seriously. I mean, he like averaged each one of us decided which story, we put these stories in an order. And then Tom not only showed which ones we most agree on, but then he averaged what number we pick these things at. I'm not even sure I understand all that math, but we'll deal with it as we move forward in the show. We also acknowledge that we could have come up with 10 more stories that could have been a top 10, and maybe we'll get a chance to talk about some of those as well. In any case, Jim Galloway, let me start with you. The story that we, on an average, chose as the 10th biggest story of the year was, I think, first, the selection of Georgian Tom Price to be Secretary of Health and Human Services, then the revelations that he had spent more than $300,000 in private jet travel, and then his ultimate firing by President
Trump.
And
in between that is a Boy Scout jamboree in West Virginia where the president promised to fire him if he didn't get him the votes for ACA.
Yeah, you know, I think, Andre, that's an interesting observation, because certainly the jet travel was what really pushed him out the door. But there's no question that President Trump has made it clear that he wants results from his people. And what didn't get as much attention, got some, including on this show, was that in many ways Price was AWOL when it came to the vote on the Affordable Care Act.
Well, I think one of the things that was interesting was that Tom Price was chosen as Health and Human Services Secretary specifically because he supposedly had a plan to replace the ACA. And so I think one of the things that we saw this year was that Republicans appeared to be very flat-footed when it finally came time to repealing and replacing the ACA, and Tom Price wasn't much of a help there in doing that.
Greg, we've heard nothing from Price since then, really.
No, not really. He appeared at a Karen Handel fundraiser earlier this month where he talked about in 2018 he wants to have some sort of healthcare initiative. But you just think, look back to if Donald Trump had lost this election right now, we'd be talking about Tom Price as a potential co-front runner for governor and David Perdue as a potential presidential candidate for 2020. So it's amazing how these things change the fortunes of one's career.
And I would say, on Tom Price, I would say we don't know the whole story yet. Yes, we know that the private jet flights were the alleged cause, but we still haven't heard from Tom Price, and I would bet you that he might be telling a different story, that it was more ACA related than anything else.
Well, yeah, that's why I raised that question, Andra.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, I kind of want to put this into a larger national story. So it's not that Tom Price was the only member of the Trump administration to kind of leave very quickly. And so I think that this is part of a larger trend that some people will look at and interpret as chaos within the administration, that you've had such turnover within, you know, less than a year in office suggests a certain amount of instability. The Trump administration would likely say that they're building creativity out of chaos. And I think that that's something that definitely remains to be seen, because a lot of us, myself included, are looking at it and our heads just spin at the number of people who have left in the past year.
Have they actually? I love that expression, creating creativity out of chaos. I've never heard them use that expression. It'd be a good one for them.
Yeah. And if you just think he really was supposed to be the point man for the ACA repeal, and when it came down to brass tacks, he couldn't get it done.
All right. So Tom Price, number 10 on the list of most important stories of the year. Number 9 is one that we can talk about a little bit, but we want to be transparent here. We are recording this year-end show on the week that Congress, that the House and Senate, will be voting on the revisions to the tax bill. In fact, on the afternoon that we're recording this, the House is preparing to vote. We expect the Senate will vote before the day, before the week is out. President Trump has said, we want this. He wants it on his desk by Christmas. So, Andra, he can give a big, fat tax break present to the American people. Number 9 on our list, tax reform.
Yeah, I mean, so this stands as being the signature legislative accomplishment of the Trump administration thus far. And so this is a big thing, but it's highly contested. About two-thirds of Americans, if you look at public opinion polling, don't approve of this idea. And I think everyone is pretty skeptical about who's going to benefit and who's not going to benefit from this. You know, in terms of the merits of the plan, I think people can have their opinions about it. But one of the things that is really interesting is that we don't think about policy as kind of a laboratory where you look to see whether or not things work and don't work. And so I'm operating under the assumption that this is going to pass and President Trump is going to sign it into law. Then this is an opportunity for citizens to just look to see whether or not the economy grows as a result of it and whether or not they're personally benefiting from it. And, you know, even though we have other data that we can look at in the past to show what the effect of tax cuts are on being able to grow the economy and on individual wealth and income, I think this is a time for people to remember this happened and then here's the result 1, 2, 3 years hence, and then we can see whether or not these types of claims about tax cuts being the, you know, drivers of a booming economy are actually real.
Right. The phrase that I have tried to avoid is the word reform. Mm-hmm. I think it's correct to call it a tax rewrite. You can call it a tax shift. It has a very, very large corporate stamp. You're bringing down the corporate rate from what, 38%, 35%.
I thought it was
39%.
39% down to 21%.
Yeah.
And the question is Andra was saying, is whether those savings on the corporate side will make their way into more investment, more hiring by companies. We probably won't know that until October, at least.
Do we get the top rate wrong? Are you kind of gesturing to us, Andra?
Well, I don't have the numbers in front of me, so I don't want to sort of quote out of turn. But I thought it was 35-21 or 37-21 for the corporate, and then I thought for the individual they were trying to take that down from 39 to about 37.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. And you know what? Our listeners can look it up.
Yeah, I could be wrong about that too.
But it's also going to have a distinct imprint in Georgia as well for the state budget. And we're already hearing from the governor's office and state officials who are just uncertain about what impact this will have in next year's budget. And they're already bringing up the specter of a special session next year, or at least a break, until they figure out how this will impact the tax receipts that the state gets, federal funding the state gets, as well as health care.
Yeah, I think nationally, I think the big impact on, is going to be the decision to drop the SALT deductions, the state and local tax
deductions.
You will no longer be able to write that off on your federal taxes.
You know, Teresa Tomlinson, the mayor of Columbus, who was in here last week, said that while we typically look at New Jersey, New York, California, states where they're going to have a huge impact because of the SALT deduction being pulled back, she pointed out that Georgia has a surprisingly large SALT overall, and it's going to affect people here too.
Yeah, Georgia does, and it's a reason why folks all over in both parties were very antsy about that part of the provision.
Okay, let's move on. Number 8, we all decided that it belonged in the top half of our top 10. Transportation, renewed interest in MARTA, the I-85 collapse. We kind of lumped them together. Now, I think had we known when we did this list that Atlanta Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport was going to go into blackout mode as part of this whole overall bucket. We might have very well moved this up to number one, Mr. Galloway.
It was number one with me. This is where I disagree. It was already before the blackout. And I think if you put it all under the heading of transportation vulnerabilities, mm-hmm. when you consider that transportation is the reason for Atlanta being where it is and why it is, and you have these slender threads like the I-85 fire in the spring, and this one fire that consumed not just the transformers but also all the backups in the airport. I think they kind of fall under the same rubric.
Greg, the I-85 fire, which closed down the highway. Snow jam now, what, 4 years ago, something like that?
2014.
And 3+ years ago, and now the airport. How much damage do you believe this does to Atlanta's image nationally? Forget about what it does. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know the impact it has on us as citizens of the metro area up here, or people across the state. But what does it do to how people perceive us?
Great question. I mean, if you think of the three biggest reputational stories coming out of Atlanta this year, it was the Super Bowl collapse, the I-85 bridge collapse, and then this airport catastrophe. The I-85 bridge collapse actually at least has a happy-ish ending. They got the bridge fixed quicker than they thought. They cut some red tape. And Atlanta pulled together, and MARTA usage went up for that time. The airport remained, the Falcon season remains to be seen. But it was a calamity. We didn't hear from the Atlanta mayor for 6 hours. We didn't hear from public leaders, and we still don't really know what the cause of the fire was.
But it is at least in the case of the I-85 collapse, and I think in the airport outage, I think you're seeing some changed minds. You're definitely seeing some changed minds on when it comes to commuter rail, as having backups for I-85, and Bill, we haven't talked about it, but I would throw in the Emory University Annex into this situation too, because that's part of the changed mind that Atlanta is going through.
You mean because part of the annexation was done to allow the city to extend light
that
rail
up the
Clifton Corridor?
It was the primary reason for doing that.
Okay. Andra, the airport was a particular fiasco, but it's not just it's local, of course, but it also points to a larger question about infrastructure across the country and the lack of attention to it.
And not just lack of attention to infrastructure, because it's not just that these were decaying infrastructures, because that really wasn't happening. It was just that there's some poor planning and no forethought into doing certain things. So putting, building materials under a bridge, that's just not a good idea. And it's funny, I drove past there, and so it was like, yeah, I never paid attention to mm-hmm. that fence. And now you're like, oh, that was flammable stuff? Oh,
whoops.
That's actually not a good idea. Or the idea that you would build redundancies into a system so that the airport doesn't lose power, but then you would build the redundancy onto the same system so that if the system collapses, then all of a sudden you're out of luck on that. Like, there just has to be better planning and thought.
But even beyond that, obviously the cause of the blackout is an anomaly that needs to be corrected. But beyond that, the fact that there aren't enough emergency lights, there aren't alternate communication systems, the sort of things that could come into play, Greg Bluestein, if, God forbid, there were a terrorist attack at any of the nation's major airports, the question becomes whether our airports are prepared and what the federal government needs to do to step in and be part of that process.
Yeah, we were fortunate. It was chaotic, but there was no chaos. There wasn't any looting. There wasn't any serious injuries. And the people who were incapacitated, basically everyday heroes, came and helped them and got them out of harm's way. But yeah, imagine if that was a situation where you needed to evacuate tens of thousands of people.
All right, we're working our way down the list. We're going to come up on the number 7 story in our top 10 in just a minute. But let's get a break out of the way, and we'll come back with more on Political Rewind. Welcome back to Political Rewind, our special New Year's edition. What were the top 10 stories in Georgia and nationally this year? You may disagree with 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10, 2 out of 10. These are just 10 stories that we all, I think, believe were important. Each of our panelists today, Greg Bluestein, Jim Galloway, Andra Gillespie, got a chance to vote on their top 10. And we're working our way down a list based on how that we averaged all of these choices together. Number seven, the KSU, Kennesaw State University cheerleading controversy and the resignation of Sam Olens as president. Jim, I need to start with you because that's your territory. You're up there in that part of Cobb County. So this story really hits home for you.
It does. It does. And we have to, I mean, behind it all is kind of the decline and disappearance of the former attorney general of the state of Georgia, yeah. who thought he was going to go into escape those primary dynamics that Sam Olens was never all that comfortable with. And instead, what he did was walk onto a campus that's in the process of changing from a parochial institution governed by hard right Republican politics into I think the third largest state public university on a par with the University of Georgia, with all the student body dynamics that includes.
Andra, it seems to me, please weigh in as you will, but as you do, I would really appreciate it if you would also discuss the fact, it seems to me, this President Trump, in the long run, is really the one who probably started the ball rolling on this. No, you don't agree.
Yeah, I mean, I understand sort of the implications of President Trump in thinking about the cheerleader controversy and sort of issues related to free speech and patriotism and those kinds of things. But I think really the problem with this started with the appointment of Sam Olens in the first place. Oh. It wasn't particularly transparent. Sam Olens doesn't have higher education experience. And so I think that a lot of the missteps he made, like the you really can't ignore your board when they tell you something, are born out of the fact that he really didn't know what he was getting himself into.
Yeah.
And so he didn't know what he was getting himself into. He didn't realize that colleges are just as political as actual politics is. And so because he didn't navigate those things well and he didn't have the experience, he also didn't have the respect of the faculty and the students as well. And so it just created a mess for him, and it's really, really unfortunate. And I would say that the lesson for this is for people who think that they can dabble in higher education administration, people who think that they can be members of boards of trustees and not understand how the corporation and the business and the structure of universities work, are setting themselves up for big controversies, lots of tension, and perhaps failure. And so lots of people think, especially if they went to college, that because they went to college, they know how to run a college. You don't know until you've actually been there. And I'm saying it as somebody, who is learning sort of as I go along too, as a faculty member. But yeah, I would take my dozen years of experience sort of working as a faculty member to get that I have a much better sense of how colleges work. And Sam Olens came in with no experience at all.
Andra's right. He didn't have higher education experience running a higher education institution. He wasn't known as a mega fundraiser. He couldn't go and make rain and raise a ton of money for KSU. But what he was expected to do is have close relationship with the Republican-led administration, with Governor Deal and with the lawmakers. And what the cheerleading controversy exposed was, hey, his relations weren't as close as he would think, he would hope them to be. And at the same time, the cheerleading issue was not helped contribute to his downfall, but wasn't the primary reason. Primary reason was that Regents were, from what I understand, were upset and frustrated at his lack of responses to their issues as well.
Right. I mean, so presidents, I mean, sometimes, even at my own university, sometimes we've had students who have, been upset if they haven't felt that, our presidents, whether it's our current one or our past one, were doing what they wanted them to do. And I'd say that, in both instances, they were actually listening to what was going on. But ultimately, at the end of the day, they are responsible to the trustees or the regents, the people who actually appoint them. And you've got to be accountable to them. You've got to understand how that organization works.
It seems right. And listening to Andra Gillespie, Jim and Greg, you understand a little bit more from the position of someone, an academic on a university campus, why an appointment like Olens could be quite distressing, as if you can come in and know how to run a university. We can understand what they might have been feeling.
Right, and more, maybe more important is that you think a president of the university might be king of that little island, and nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, he has got how many members of the Board of Regents are there? 10?
Yeah, I think there's at least a dozen.
He's got a dozen bosses there alone.
You got to want a last word here.
Yeah, and this is also like you've got to respect faculty governance, which is why faculty should have had a say in this, like, you know, to begin with.
So just to finish that, Greg, I just want to point something out. A while ago, you said what could have been. Had Tom Price not gone to HHS, perhaps he'd now be a candidate for governor of Georgia, as most people expected he very well could have been. Sam Olens made a turn in his road some time ago. Mm-hmm. He decided 8-plus years ago, the first time when he left Cobb County Commission, he wanted to run for statewide office. There was a lot of talk he could be a strong candidate for governor. He was weighing it. We do know, all of us, that he was looking at running for governor back then. He chose instead to run for AG. What might have been for Sam Olens if he'd gone into the governor's race? The potential was there for him to win. So it's just an interesting what might have been.
We could be talking about him as a potential leading candidate for governor now. But what happened was once he made it clear he wasn't running for governor and wanted another job, he also lost any cover he would get from Governor Deal. Yeah. I mean, once he was at KSU, Governor Deal and any political allies were saying, it's all yours. But
okay, I'm getting behind. I got to slow you down here. I've got to move on. We all picked as number six the Atlanta mayor's race and the City Hall corruption investigation simultaneously, and all of us put it right about in this position. Greg, beyond the local Atlanta interest in this race, why is this one of the top 10 stories of the year?
Well, first, the ongoing corruption probe, the federal corruption probe, could end up disgracing our main city. And, you know, we all saw what happened with Bill Campbell, who ended up serving federal prison time for his role in another corruption scandal. But beyond that, too, of course, the election of the state's largest mayor of the state's largest city and economic centerpiece is important to every resident around the state. And the mayor will be the voice of Atlanta and really a leading voice of the region politically.
And there's the fact that, remember, we winnowed this down. We started off with, I think, maybe a dozen candidates at the first forum that I went to up in Buckhead that Sam Massell put on. And then we got down to the classic white candidate, black candidate in a runoff. The fact that Kasim Reed was backing his successor, I think, but even there, there was a struggle. I think we caught a glimpse of what Atlanta politics are going to look like in the next eight years.
What does that mean?
Which means you're going to the election of an African American is not guaranteed, and you're going to see some of these very interesting coalitions develop, like the one that lined up at the last minute behind Mary Norwood. In the runoff, you had Shirley Franklin, you had Peter Ammon, you had Caesar Mitchell, all backing her, and the difference was what, something like 800 votes and change.
So, I mean, I think that that's definitely part of it. So people are looking at how demographic changes in Atlanta are going to shape city politics going forward. One of the things that was interesting is that while we saw this shift amongst elites and we saw kind of interesting bedfellows in terms of who aligned with whom in the runoff, if we go back and we look at the data about who voted for whom, the rank and file was not necessarily paying that much attention to who their elites were, particularly amongst African Americans. And so African Americans were largely immune to the fact that Shirley Franklin and Caesar Mitchell endorsed Mary Norwood, and they went and voted for Keisha Lance Bottoms to such a degree that actually allowed her to be able to win.
And Bernie Sanders endorsing Vince Ford and Andrew Young endorsing Caesar Mitchell at the outset as well.
But I don't think we can move away from this bill without saying that the LGBT community in Atlanta really showed some impressive chops at various stages in the voting, especially when the third place candidate was Kathy Woolard. She carried, I think, 37% of Atlanta into cab.
Yeah, she came very close. And I think if you had a dollar for every person who said, you know, I'd vote for Kathy Woolard if I thought she really had a chance to win, you might not have to work in that job a whole lot longer, Galloway.
About 17 LGBT candidates were on the ballots around Metro Atlanta, and about half of them ended up winning. So they're showing the clout.
I'm going to exercise moderator's privilege and put numbers 5 and 4 essentially together because they fall under the same basic category. The Alabama Senate race was number 5, the upset victory by Democrat Doug Jones over Roy Moore. And then, of course, the Georgia 6th congressional district race, which proved to be a close race in what has been a largely Republican district. So they both sort of come together under the same heading. But, Andra, we haven't had you in here since the Alabama Senate race. I really want your take on what you think happened over there, aside from the fact that Roy Moore perhaps was one of the worst candidates any of us have seen in our long years of following politics.
So I happened to go to Alabama last week and hung out with people who were doing independent expenditure work, particularly trying to mobilize African-American voters to turn out. And so I think that that's the story. And so I think it's become a surprise to people that, like, black people turn out to vote and they can sway elections. But because this isn't the first time that that's happened, but people noticed it this time around. And I think they noticed it this time around because numerically Democrats are at a disadvantage in a state like Alabama. But what they showed was that, you know, if you can rally behind a candidate, especially, you know, albeit in the face of a highly controversial, very bad candidate from the opposing party, that sort of uptick in African-American turnout kind of coupled with a decline in Republican turnout because people were so conflicted about Roy Moore could, in fact, be a winning strategy. I mean, I think fundamentally, the Alabama race and the Georgia 6th race were pretty different, is that you had mobilized Democrats who knew that they were at a numerical disadvantage. And I think the difference was that the Republican candidate was so controversial in Alabama that you could actually demobilize Republican votes in a way that Karen Handel just wasn't going to do in the Georgia 6th.
Yeah, I'll take the flip side of that. I mean, one was seen by Democrats as a moral victory. One was actually a real victory. But if you look at the at John Ossoff race, that wasn't a race about, just as Alabama was, as important as the black vote was in Alabama. John Ossoff race was the sort of test for Democrats to get the white vote in Republican areas. Although he maximized vote, it also showed you when you maximize the Republican side of the equation and you get Republicans mobilized over central themes, it's tough for them. And that's going to be the dialogue of next year's race, of what happens to those sort of moderate white voters in the suburbs in Georgia elections.
Right. And that's, to me, that's where the importance of this race is, because you saw a northern DeKalb in certain places, like in the 6th district in northern DeKalb, in certain places in North Fulton, you saw state legislators, Republican state legislators, very, very vulnerable. Yeah. And I'm thinking of Fran Miller, Tom Taylor up in Dunwoody, who decided not to run for another year, or he won't mm-hmm. face re-election this year. You could really see some gains. And we're forgetting the District 6 Senate race.
Yeah, where it's flipped. We now have a Democrat who's going to represent that district up there. I want to go back to Roy Moore and Doug Jones for just a minute, Andra. Democrats obviously have a reason to celebrate a victory. They closed the gap of Republicans versus Democrats in this U.S. Senate. But I have to wonder about this. And I want to test this with all of you, because you're the pros on this stuff. I'm not sure. Do we really believe that Doug Jones is necessarily a safe Democratic vote? Obviously, he caucuses with Democrats, but he's also got to pay attention to the constituency back home when he comes. He's going to have to run for re-election, and he's not probably going to face a guy like Roy Moore. So I wonder if he's really a reliably safe Democratic vote, or if, in fact, Republicans see him as someone they might be able to sway here and there, and if that's one of the reasons that President Trump has been so lovely to him.
Well, yes and no. So he has already said that there are things that he would consider voting along with Republicans
right.
on. I think on big, big issues, you're probably going to see him walk in lockstep with the Democrats. I think he will probably be convinced of that. But, I mean, he's hinted that, you know, if the infrastructure bill is a good infrastructure bill, that he, you know, would be likely to go along with that. And so I think who you should be comparing him to is, you know, not necessarily Chuck Schumer, whether or not he goes along with Chuck Schumer, but how he looks different or similar to, say, a Joe Manchin. Or a Heidi
yes,
Heitkamp.
I was going to say the West Virginia the West Virginia senator might be a good partner for him.
Yeah, and so I mean I think that there might be some places where Manchin gives him cover to do things that are going to look inherently more conservative, and he's going to bill it as pragmatism. And it was funny, I can't remember if I said this to my friends when I was in Alabama, but that man's going to have amazing constituent services, just amazing, just in terms of how responsive he's going to have to be to his constituents if he has any hope of being more than just, you know, sort of somebody who's filling the term of Jeff Sessions.
Okay, but that, to some extent, really kind of makes a point I was interested in, which is, Greg, this is still a Republican state. Doug Jones won through a set of circumstances that were unusual, to say the least. And so it does seem to me he's going to have to be looking over his shoulder. Andra may be right. Maybe he does it by constituent services. But he's, I mean, if he gets branded as just another Chuck Schumer Democrat, he's not going to hold that seat very long.
Exactly. And he didn't run as some sort of moderate you know, Republican in Democrat clothing. He ran as a pretty liberal candidate who wanted to save Obamacare. And he you know, he had strong views on abortion and issues like that were very polarizing in Alabama. So it's going to be very interesting. He might be a test case of how Democrats can now win in states like Alabama and Georgia and Mississippi and Louisiana, or he might just be a, you know, a half a term anomaly.
But you can't get by past the fact that this is the first white Democrat from the Deep South in Congress since U.S. Rep. John Barrow was tossed out of office.
Yeah.
Even if he only lasts for these next two, 3 years, I think it's significant.
All right, let's finish by going back to Georgia's 6th congressional district. Jim, is that state, Karen Handel is up. It was a special election, so she only serves for a year before she faces re-election next November. Is that seat safe for her at this point, or is she going to have another battle?
I think she's going to have another battle, but I think in the end, I think it is a safe seat, because I think what we're going to see is we're going to see Democrats really start to concentrate on where they put their money and where they put their forces, and I think they're going to put their money on the 7th District and Rob Woodall in Lawrenceville.
Congressional incumbents, they don't get beaten very often, do they?
They typically have a high rate of reelection, and oftentimes if they see the handwriting on the wall, they'll quit while they're ahead. Oftentimes when you hear people saying, I need to spend more time with my family, what that really means is I saw a poll and I'm going to lose, so I'm just going to bow out gracefully. I think the big wild card here is how many resignations we have, because all of a sudden we have unflattering revelations coming out about more people, because that's making more races more competitive than they probably would have been in the past.
All right, let's do this. Let's get another break in. On our special edition of Political Rewind, we're counting down the top 10 stories, listing of the top 10 stories, nevertheless, an interesting and somewhat comprehensive list of the top 10 stories of 2017. We're going to continue with number 3 on that list. Can you guess what it is? We'll be right back. Welcome back to a special edition of Political Rewind. Yes, we are all taking this long New Year's weekend off, and so we're doing a year-end show that we recorded in advance, talking about the top 10 stories of 2017. By the way, as we were sitting here recording this show, and we mentioned this earlier, the U.S. House did in fact pass the tax bill that we talked about a bit earlier. You'll already know that news as being a week old, but for us, it's fresh. Jim Galloway is here, Andra Gillespie, and Greg Bluestein are joining me. Number 3, we said, was the Affordable Care Act fight. Greg Bluestein, it's a big story, obviously, because for, 7-8 years, Republicans said repeatedly over and over and over again, put them in power, they're going to get rid of ACA. They voted against ACA, 40, 50 times in the House to kill it. And, of course, the reason it's a big story is because every effort, although it passed the House, they were never able to get this accomplished.
Yeah, as Andra said earlier, it seemed like once they actually were in position to do what they long promised to do, they couldn't get together and do it. And that's exactly kind of what happened. And there was that dramatic thumbs-down vote from John McCain, and there was a real, real, real struggle for Republicans to get all on the same page on the ACA repeal. And I think at the time of this telling, they think they have a partial solution in the tax bill that would take away the individual mandate requirement. But yet, you know, for it seems like months we were writing and talking about what will happen with ACA, what the ramifications will be. And it looks like next year, especially with Doug Jones's victory, there will be no formidable effort to revisit healthcare like this.
Yeah, I would broaden this topic and point to the Republican attempt, the attempt by Donald Trump to erase Barack Obama and all his work of the previous 8 years. Because that's been a major theme of what's been going on, and that's really what was at the heart of the Obamacare repeal effort.
You know, that's an interesting way to express this, Andra. Now let me ask you about that. There's no question that to some extent, some of that effort to erase President Obama is a result of Trump and Republican feelings that businesses should be unfettered, regulation just stifles innovation and growth and all that sort of stuff. But in all of that, there seems to have been great personal animus as well, yes?
Well, I mean, President Trump talks about President Obama a lot, to the point where it sometimes seems unseemly. And so that's definitely there. But, you know, in all honesty, if we look at some empirical work that some of my friends have done, what we'll see is that it's not unusual that President Trump would take this particular track. And so, for instance, if you look at support for provisions of Obamacare and actually talking about Obamacare as Obamacare, Obamacare becomes less popular when you attach President Obama's name to it. And, you know, so for a lot of us, we interpret this as being attached to racial resentment. And so I think the challenge for President Trump and for the Republicans was that while people expressed concerns and doubts about Obamacare, they actually like some of the provisions. And so taking those away is actually harder. And then there were the larger process issues about them not having their stuff together in terms of being able to put that together. And so I think for President Trump, he was able to tap into anti-Obama sentiment. He was able to tap into racial resentment in order to get elected. And that's been able to carry him pretty far. But now there's the substantive issue that you have to deal with. And people actually, you know, like health care. Next year, they're going to like Social Security if you try to go after that. And you have to figure out sort of, you know, what's the balance between welfare reform and entitlement reform. So there are all these things that people talk about that you can activate people on based on prejudices. But when you get down to brass tacks, there's some things that people fundamentally actually like and have come to expect. And that's going to be harder to take away.
You know, Greg, it strikes me that once you remove the individual mandate from ACA, you're already beginning what could be a slow spiral downward for the Affordable Care Act, simply because if you don't have a requirement that people need to be insured, then you change the whole dynamic of the risk pool. You're going to have healthy young people decide not to get insurance. There's going to be less money in the pool for older people who need it. I mean, that's really a significant blow that Republicans accomplish without doing the major dramatic repeal.
And that seems to be a central undercurrent of Plan B, Plan C, whatever we call this for repealing or for fighting back against Obamacare is it also includes the underfunding of promotions about healthcare exchanges and other issues, letting these healthcare exchanges sort of wind down on their own. And there was talk for a little bit while about bipartisan consensus over shoring up certain parts of the healthcare act that we've kind of seen lie fallow right now. It's just kind of disappeared. And I don't know if that will come up again next year.
No, but I will tell you what, just throwing it forward, I think it's going to be very interesting to watch and see what shape the race for state insurance commissioner in Georgia becomes. Because you've had, you've got Ralph Hudgens, who's going to be retiring. He was a adamant foe of the ACA and declared his hostility toward it. And you've got This could be a really competitive area for a Democrat. I know several are looking.
Interesting. Well, we'll watch how that develops. All right, let's keep moving. Number two on our list of the top 10, the story that sort of the average of what we all said picked as number two is the Mueller-Russia investigation. And, of course, I think we included in that everything that happened with President Trump, the firing of FBI Director Comey, and Sally Yates's, our own Sally Yates's role in all of that, having been the one who went and warned the White House about Mike Flynn particularly. So what's interesting, Andra, about this, the Russia probe, is that, it was going to end at the end of this year, according to the Trump White House. It's now increasingly clear there's no reason to think it will be over even in the first months of 2018. There's a lot to dig into, and it's going to continue unless the president decides to fire Robert Mueller.
So it's been an interesting week in terms of sort of dealing with that. So President Trump has said that he's not going to fire Bob Mueller. There are reports that his lawyers have been telling President Trump this is going to be over very, very quickly, and it seems as though that has kind of satisfied him at this point. But I think for the rest of us, we're looking at this going, there's no way this is going to be resolved anytime soon. And so I think for people on both sides of the aisle, everybody just has to brace themselves that this is going to be a very long investigation and that news is going to trickle out very slowly and that we just have to wait to see what would happen. I don't know how President Trump, if the rumors are true, if the stories are true, that he's been assured that this is going to end quickly. I don't understand how he even believes that that's possible, right? Because we just haven't seen enough yet for anybody to think that there aren't more shoes that are left to drop as a result of this.
Greg, Sally Yates became a big player in this when she was fired. It wasn't directly because of her warnings to the White House about Russia, problems with Michael Flynn and the Russians. It had to do with her deciding that she wasn't going to follow the president's order on the first Muslim ban. Nevertheless, certainly going to the White House, trying to get them to pay attention, put a big circle around her, I would think.
Yeah, and she has become one of the leading critics in the nation of Donald Trump. And up until this week, you know, at this telling, she had another column, I think it was in USA Today or Washington Post. She has been a frequent voice of concern about Donald Trump's stance toward the Justice Department, toward FBI agents, toward the Mueller investigation. And she has emerged again as a national player and a potential candidate for higher office in Georgia and down the road.
And the other thing about this, Bill, is that you have to remember is it represents a very serious split between traditional Republican foreign policy and attitudes toward Russia and President Donald Trump's individual assessment of Russia and Vladimir Putin. It was on display just last week when President Trump gave his national security address. He was reading from text, so it was very much along the traditional lines of Russia is an enemy that can't be trusted and we need to be wary. But that's completely at odds with the many phone calls he seems to exchange with Putin. And they both say great things about each other.
Let's go back to Sally Yates, because it was a big year for her. Greg Bluestein has already raised the question once again of whether she'll become a candidate for higher office, presumably in the state of Georgia. We all know her. Do we see that happening, really?
If she were going to do it, she would be running in 2018, and that means she would be doing something now. So I don't think so.
I think that's absolutely right. Do you have a take on that?
I mean, I think I would agree, and then I think it's a question of for which office. And so since I'm going to assume that not this year, I think it becomes a question of, you know, does she challenge somebody like David Perdue for the Senate?
I'm with Andra. I think 2020 might be her last chance.
And I think that there is nothing in her basic makeup as an individual which is crying out to be an elected representative or to run for an office. She feels to me like someone who always wants to dig her teeth into just doing strong work, not worrying about
politics. I think
politics.
She wants to be a U.S. Attorney General.
There you go. All right. Let's move on. We've got one story left. The story that essentially we all agreed was, we all thought this story should certainly be in the top couple of stories. I put it as number one. Did anybody else put sexual harassment, the Me Too movement, and all of the things that we've been watching unfold? Anybody else have that as number one? I did. No?
I think I either had one or two. I can't remember.
Okay.
I was flighty in how I ranked it, but I wanted to talk about this. So
well,
it was definitely my number one.
Well, then this is your chance.
Yeah.
Talk.
So, you know, it's been interesting to watch this movement unfold. And so what I see happening here in the social movement literature, a coin was termed 30 years ago by Doug McAdam called cognitive liberation. So it's this idea that people recognize that there is a favorable political moment to deal with longstanding issues. And I think that this was kind of the year of cognitive liberation for a lot of women. You saw women come forward, and you saw their stories being taken seriously in ways that they hadn't been before collectively. And so that's just opened the door for more women to be able to come out with their stories, and men too. And we've seen some powerful people actually taken out or demoted as a result of these experiences. And so I think, you know, we all want to know sort of how long this moment lasts and what's the longstanding change that's going to come of that. You know, I suspect that, you know, in organizations left and right, we're going to see changes in how people address sexual harassment policies in terms of sort of what is considered appropriate etiquette. And then also what, you know, are the appropriate tactics to take in terms of actually being able to provide redress for people. So maybe, you know, non-disclosure agreements and other things go away. But, you know, it is heartening. It is also really discouraging almost every day to wake up and hear about a new allegation of somebody who I once respected, you know, who just apparently behaves very horribly behind closed doors.
But a lot of people are going to be saying this began with the Harvey Weinstein accusations that I think they started spreading, what, in September?
Mm-hmm. October.
Yeah, it was late.
I would turn the clock back to January 21st in Washington, D.C., on the day after Donald Trump was inaugurated. And you had, what, 700,000, mostly women, in the streets.
In so D.C. and 60,000 in Atlanta. And
right. And so, I mean, I think the Women's March is definitely sort of important in terms of women saying that they were going to stand up. But I also think that, especially with respect to sexual harassment, we can actually start to trace this actually before 2017. So think about it. Last year, it was
to the Hollywood Access tapes.
Well, not just that. Yeah, because, I mean, that's the one place, one of the few places where it hasn't quite worked yet. but, I mean, you could look at Roger Ailes. And so and you could look before October at Bill O'Reilly. You could look at the allegations about Bill Cosby that, you know, started to really be taken seriously for the first time in 2015. So in all honesty, as we look back retrospectively, we'll see that this had actually been building for a long period of time. And then there's the moment in the fall where with Harvey Weinstein, everything just, the floodgates really opened.
I don't see how we go back. I cannot imagine, Andra, you asked this question, how far, you know, will it sustain? It strikes me that this is a seismic shift that can't possibly go back. Now, maybe I'm overly optimistic, maybe I'm naive, but among other things, I think men are recalibrating their understanding about how they themselves have viewed, forget about harassment, you may have never come near that, but just in general, a recognition by men that they have perhaps not understood women in the way that they absolutely must.
I mean, and I've had some really interesting conversations with people about this that I think hopefully will move forward. I think what people are waiting to see is whether or not there's a backlash. You know, there are some men who have pushed back on the allegations that have been made against them. I think people are worried about potential fatigue. And then, you know, just to use the civil rights movement as an example, one of my old professors and another co-author would describe this as sometimes you have like two steps forward and one step back. And so, you know, we'd like to think that progress is linear. It's not always linear. It's jagged. And so I think we just want to see where the jags might actually
I do want
up.
To make one important point about what I said. I don't think it's because men are waking up that this isn't going to go back. I think it's because women have awakened and they're not going to let it change. But I do think that men's involvement in this is important too, as are the institutions that have over the years been incubators for bad behavior in some cases. All right, those are the top 10. Almost every story on our list in some way or another is going to play out in 2018, I think it's safe to say, although let's hope there's not another airport blackout or another I-85 fire. real quick, do you have a sense of what we might be talking, what do you think we might talk about next year at this time, Jim?
I think we might be talking about the takeover of the U.S. House by Democrats and whether Nancy Pelosi survives as Speaker.
Interesting. Andra?
I would also say that we should be looking at the midterm elections next year. I'm also going to be curious to see what else happens with healthcare. So it may not be an Obamacare repeal, but there might be other attempted tweaks that fall along the lines of health insurance reform that I'm waiting to see whether or not those materialize. And of course, I would also look at the Mueller probe and to see what actually comes out next year as a result of that.
The race for governor and congressional seats, especially in Atlanta's northern suburbs, are going to be just fascinating, exciting adventures to watch and to cover for us political reporters. And also, we're going to take a close look at Amazon. Amazon might just well be one of the biggest stories. If it goes how state recruiters want it to go, Amazon's likely to make their decision up early next year. And Georgia folks are very confident that they're on the top of the list. So we'll see.
Without predicting an outcome, because you've got to be a little crazy to do that, to predict one. I'm going to be really interested in watching the Stacey Abrams race for governor, because it's two candidates who are looking at very different ways to build a victory. Can Stacey Abrams somehow re-energize what I think of as the yellow dog Democratic coalition of the past, which used to like Democrats routinely, add just enough African-American votes to get to the finals to be the Democratic candidate? Or is Stacey Abrams' tactic of building a strong African-American base, hoping to engage just enough white voters to get there? I think that is just going to be a fascinating race to watch.
And I think that has national implications as well, because there is a fight in the National Democratic Party about whether or not it's even worth it to go after working class white voters anymore.
We are out of time. Dr. Andre Gillespie, Greg Bluestein, Jim Galloway, thank you so much for helping us with this year in review. Look, I mean, I think we all would agree that this has been one of the most exciting, frustrating, dramatic, surprising years we have ever seen in politics. And I'm really glad that we've been here at Political Rewind to help break it down for you, both the national stories and the state and local stories as well. As we leave you with Ella Fitzgerald, what are you doing? What are you going to do New Year's Eve? I just want to take a minute to thank all of you who have been such wonderful listeners to this show. You tweet to us, you send me emails, you stop me when I'm out and about to talk to me about this show, and you obviously have been very, very engaged, and I'm very grateful for that. Happy New Year, Olivia Rheingold, Tom Faust, Tyler Morris, our team in the control room, and to all of you out there, a very happy New Year. We'll see you in 2018.
Maybe I'm crazy to suppose I'd ever be the one you chose out of the thousand invitations. Jackpot question.